solicited by a Florida corporation called Radiator Aid concerning the franchise and sale of radiator repair equipment. Mr. Kiner first saw this in a written advertisement and was subsequently solicited over the phone by Radiator Aid on several occasions. Radiator Aid's pitch was, please come to Florida, come look at the equipment, stay at our townhome, and we will show you what we got and why you ought to buy it. Finally, Mr. Kiner accepts the invitation, flies to Florida, looks at the equipment, and decides that he's interested in it, and says to them, I can do this with my own bank, I can finance it, I have good credit back home. And they said, no, let's do it with the agreement that we already have here. We'd like to do it this way. And the agreement that they had, Your Honors, was what has come to be known in the trade as a financing lease. These are strange animals. These are animals that say the word lease, but the person who's leasing the equipment to you doesn't own at the time of the lease preparation, typically, the product, buys it from a manufacturer, and in turn, quote, leases it, close quote, to the consumer. The consumer pays interest. That's exactly what the interest, the difference between the principal amounts that the leasing company pays the manufacturer and what ultimately is collected in the form of lease payments. But in any event, there was this agreement. The only agreement that was signed in this transaction bore the insignia, to employ the words from Knight versus International Harvester, bore the insignia of Colonial Leasing. Now, what Mike Kiner did not know as his flight winged its way from Texas to Florida was that for some time, Colonial had been corresponding with and talking over the phone with Radiator Aid, because Radiator Aid knew they had Mr. Kiner coming, and they wanted to make sure that when he got there, they were prepared. So they got all of the credit information from Mr. Kiner. They supplied it to Colonial. Colonial took that information, ran credit checks on Mr. Kiner, did not inform Mr. Kiner that he had somehow applied for a lease. Mr. Kiner does not even learn of Colonial Leasing's name until he gets to Florida and is presented with this document. And so he finally does sign a document that is called an equipment lease. Colonial Leasing's representative testified in this case that is the standard way business is done, that had they not accepted this lease agreement, then Radiator Aid could have sent this contract to some other leasing company, that they did supply the forms to Radiator Aid, that Radiator Aid had the contract proposal, and of course there was some dispute in the record, not dispute, but lots of discussion in the record as to whether or not at the time the contract was sent from Colonial to Radiator Aid, whether or not it was really a contract or simply a proposal. Finally, the witness on cross-examination by Mr. Hall did testify that yes, it was, until Mr. Kiner signed it and Colonial accepted it, it was a proposal. Mr. Hall asked, well, sir, did you supply this contract to Radiator Aid? Yes, we did. Was this a proposal that Radiator Aid was then going to present to Mr. Kiner? And finally he said, yes, it was. And of course, that was the case. So if you look at the transaction from the point of view of Colonial is in business to make money, interest, in connection with the financing of equipment purchases. It gets its business through manufacturers who have their contracts on site to present to prospective purchasers, and it's precisely what happened in this case. The testimony of the witness from Colonial was this was a standard way of doing business. And so, Your Honors, though we're not here talking today and with emphasis about the issue of agency, the issue of parent authority and the like, it is the position, strong position, that this verdict could well stand on the findings of agency, for it is quite clear that the agent, for purposes of presenting this proposal to the consumer in this case, Mr. Kiner, was a Radiator Aid. Now, let's talk, though, about the finding about liability of Colonial. The jury found that the equipment that was finally delivered to Mr. Kiner was worth $2,000. That was pursuant to Mr. Kiner's testimony. He said this product had never worked, that he had been able to do some minor repairs of radiators, but the big jobs were impossible because he did not have a proper hoist to get the big radiators out of the motor well in the automobiles.
The only testimony of value then was the purchaser's testimony.
Yes, but he also testified that he was familiar with the radiator business and was, after having been in it, of course, pursuant to this transaction, and that this was a statement of market value. The words market value, Your Honor, may not appear in the Q&A in the record, but it's clear from reading that they were talking about what this would bring. The issue was what this would bring versus how much is it worth to you. If you asked Mr. Kinert, and he was asked during trial, how much is it worth to you, Mr. Kiner said it had been useless to him and cost him a great deal of extra time on his part. So as far as Mr. Kiner was concerned, the product value was zero. But anyway, the $2,000 was what the jury found. They also found the amount that he had paid in was that he had obligated himself to pay was $16,909.20, and that he had had out-of-pocket losses apart from the difference in value of $1,500. The unconscionability finding was this. Do you find that Colonial Leasing greatly overcharged Mr. Kindert? Answer, we do. If you have answered that yes, then answer the following question. Otherwise, do not. Following question was, do you find that such conduct was an unconscionable action or course of action with a statutory definition for the instruction? The answer was,
statutory
we do.
Definition.
Statutory definition, right? Pardon me, Judge, for interrupting.
No, I
yes,
interrupted you.
Yes, it was directly out of the statute 1745-5. So the jury found unconscionability, not based generally, as we often do submit it. We often do submit it in connection with this transaction. Did Colonial commit an unconscionable action or course of action? Answer yes or no. This one was more clearly related to the greatly overcharging. And so what is the greatly overcharging? Respondent in its brief, and I suspect we'll all shortly hear in its oral argument, is telling us that, well, since Radiator A paid $10,000 to the manufacturer, and only was going to charge pursuant to the lease over $16,000, surely that cannot be an overcharge. Well, Your Honors, the overcharge and the unconscionability the statute speaks of is what is the value to the consumer versus what he paid for it. The evidence is clear that Mr. Kiner obligated himself to pay over the five-year term $16,909.20. He paid before he finally gave up and this thing ever working, something like $9,600. He'd almost paid what it is that Radiator Aid had paid out what Colonial paid out to Radiator Aid by the time the lease was only half through. But the point is that he had obligated himself to pay $16,909. He had paid $9,600, and he got value of $2,000, or if you want to take his testimony about what it was really worth to him, zero. Now, that's the unconscionability, any action or course of action, the statute tells us, that results in a gross disparity between the value received and the consideration paid. And disparities as little as $150 or whatever that lawyer was paid in the DeBakey versus Staggs case for agreeing to do a name change and then not doing it was held to be unconscionable because what the consumer got was zero. So we have a several thousand dollar difference between value received and consideration paid, and surely meets the prong of unconscionability that deals with disparity in value. So we believe that Colonial was found liable for its own conduct of overcharging, that is, agreeing to get more than the product value would warrant, and that was found to be a producing cause of actual damages. And so one need not delve into the mysteries of inextricably intertwined and what the court really meant when it said that, and that it means something different. And I noticed the court has granted writ just past week in Brown versus Galleria Area Ford, in which once again the issue of inextricably intertwined is raised on the issue of successor corporate liability. where the real misrepresentations apparently are made by Corporation A, who by the time the misrepresentations are proven to be untrue has been sold to Corporation B, thus leaving the consumer apparently, according to the Court of Appeals in that case, in a remediless situation. But in this case, that, while an interesting topic, is not one that needs to be reached. Here, there has been a finding of unconscionable action or course of action. Now, clearly, though, if we needed inextricably intertwined, certainly it is here. Once again, and I failed to mention a fact I'm sure Mr. Hall would remind you of when I got back to table, is that the first payment made by Mr. Kinder was to Radiator Aid. It included his first month's rent payment and his security deposit. That amount went into Radiator Aid and was credited by Colonial when it sent its $10,000, its $9,100 over to Radiator Aid. In other words, what was happening, in effect, and there was a lot of testimony about how this would have worked, is that the money was paid into Radiator Aid and what was due, really, over to Colonial. But instead of sending it over to Colonial and having it sent right back in the form of a $10,000 check to Colonial, it was simply credited and Colonial sent the balance, which is $9,100. But the Colonial witness testified that that was the first payment and that was the security deposit and that went to them, that is, went to Colonial. So here is a manufacturer who is provided with, or a seller who is provided with, the financing agreements. The financing agency uses that person to present the proposal to the consumer. He is authorized, obviously, to accept payment pursuant to the lease, and I would urge your honors that that is inextricably intertwined if that term means anything. And so for both those reasons, we believe the unconscionability finding must stand, supports the finding of treble damages under the DTPA, and for all those reasons, that portion should be affirmed as well as the portion on usury to which Mr. Labadie will now turn the court's attention, unless there are questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court. My name is Tim Labadie, and I'm going to discuss with you now the usury portion of this case. In the trial court, we submitted three issues which related to the usury cause of action. Special issue 14, 15, and 16. Special issue 14 asked whether the transaction between Michael Kinard and Colonial Pacific was a device for accomplishing a loan, and the jury said yes, it was. Special issue 15 was asked whether the charges in that agreement were basically interest charges for the compensation for use or detention of money amounting to $10,000 or less, and the jury said yes to that one. Special issue number 16 was a defensive issue by Colonial Pacific, and it asked whether there was a time price differential involved in this transaction, and the jury said no. And a judgment was signed and entered by the trial court based on those issues, giving the statutory penalties under Article 5069, 106, 1 and 2. The Court of Appeals, however, reversed that finding and that judgment, and it's really not too clear why they did it, but I'll quote to you from the opinion. They said that the contract which Colonial Pacific furnished did not violate any laws of this state. See Texas Revised Civil Statute Annotated Article 5069 6.01F, which applies only to contracts entered in this state. It goes on later, and this is on page 674 of the opinion. Clearly, the agreement was not entered into in this state. Consequently, it does not violate the prohibitions contained in Article 5069 6.01. The court apparently was thinking that this was a retail installment contract which had to be subject to Chapter 6 of 5069. That is just clearly wrong. The 5069 Chapter 6 relates only to retail installment contracts of a which involve goods that relate to personal property used for personal, household, or family use. And of course, this the radiator equipment was used for Mr. Tiny's business, and it exempts out in Chapter 6 business or commercial use of goods. So it clearly cannot apply to this. Chapter 6 also says that it will not reach to those agreements that are not entered into this state. So I think that's why the Court of Appeals was saying why this contract did not violate any laws of the state. However, the jury found that it did violate the laws of the state, namely Article 5069, Chapter 1, which regulates usury and excessive interest. Now, in the jury findings that I already told you about support that. Now, the evidence to go behind that was, and I guess before that, there's a case that came out just several weeks ago, and it's up before this court on an application for writ of error, and it's called Potomac Leasing versus El Paso Housing Authority. And in that case, the Court of Appeals came out, and it had to deal with a leasing agreement. And it said, well, there's no usury in a leasing transaction. There can't be. And that's a true statement of law. In a pure leasing situation, you can't have usury because it's just not, it doesn't fall within Article 5069. But before you can apply that principle of law, you have to determine what the nature of the transaction was. And the courts look to the intention of the parties to determine what the nature of the transaction was. They don't look to what the contract says or the agreement says, even though it says leasing agreement. They look to the intention. And in Security Life Insurance Company versus Executive Car Leasing, the court set out the test to how you look to the intention of the parties. And in that case, the court said, if there is an agreement and there is a purchase option for a nominal consideration at the end of the lease term, then that is construed as a sale, not as a lease. And there's many cases that go in that tradition. And what you do is, because a lease, what you do is you're contemplating using equipment or goods or whatever you're using just for a specific period of time and then returning them back. But in a sale or a conditional sale, what is happening is the seller or the buyer is using the equipment or whatever it is for a period of time, and ownership will be transferred once these conditions are met, namely paying off these payments over a period of time, and that the equipment will not be returned to the seller. The testimony in this case from Colonial Pacific, the witness from Colonial Pacific says that they never intended to have this equipment returned to them. They didn't want that equipment. And so, plus the evidence is showing that there's a purchase option in this agreement. And Plaintiff's Exhibit Number 5, which was introduced and admitted, that there was a purchase option that Mr. Kiner could buy this equipment at the end of the term for a dollar. And cases that are going on in that in other contexts are saying that these are sales. These aren't leases. These are
leases. Plaintiff's Exhibit 5 says that at the end of the lease term, you can buy it for a dollar.
Exactly. It's the purchase option. So,
what mechanism, if any, was there under the lease for getting out of the lease early?
None for Mr. Kiner.
Well, that's who I mean.
Right. He had, in fact, that's another point I was going to make later on, is that this was a non-cancelable lease. He could not get out of it. And once he did stop paying, of course, Colonial Pacific sends them demand letters, sends them notices of acceleration, says, you know, we want everything. We want the rest of the lease payments. In fact, they filed a counterclaim in the trial court trying to get those payments, which they did not receive. Now, really, so if you look at to the intention of the parties, you see here that this is clearly a sale. They never wanted it back. They had an option to purchase for a dollar at the end of the term, which is a nominal consideration. So here we look now to the elements of usury, which are clearly established that there must be a loan, which the jury found in Special Issue Number 14. They said that it was a device for a loan, so we have an issue. We have a finding on that. There must be an absolute obligation to repay the principal. the lease itself says this is non-cancelable. You have to pay this stuff no matter what happens. And there's a letter in the transcript. I don't remember the exhibit number now, but it's a letter from Colonial Pacific to Mr. Kiner saying, well, if you have any trouble with Radiator A, that's between you and him, them. You keep paying us. You can't get out of this deal. So there was an absolute obligation to repay there. And then there must be an exaction of compensation greater than that allowed by law for the use or detention of money, i.e. there must be excessive interest. And Special Issue Number 15 found that these charges that were being made, the difference between the $10,000 and what Mr. Kiner was going to have to pay, was interest. And basically, really, when you get down to it, there's really no dispute here of what this thing is, what this agreement was. In the trial court, and this is in the transcript in Colonial Pacific's motion for judgment NOV and to disregard jury findings, they make the statement that this is a retail installment sales contract. They admit that there was a sale going on here all the time. And so when you have that and you have the jury findings supporting all this, just as a matter of law then, all it takes is looking at the contract itself and determining what the principle was, and determining, another thing, there was no agreement for interest here at all. And the testimony from Colonial Pacific witness admits that as well in the transcript, that there was never an agreement to pay interest. So, according to 5069.103, when there's no agreement to a specified rate, the maximum that can be charged is 6%. So you have the principal of 10%, you have the maximum of 6%, you have the principal of $10,000, maximum interest of 6%, and just as a matter of law, you can go through and calculate the usury penalties. And that has been done, and in fact, Colonial Pacific did that very thing in their brief to the Court of Appeals, where they were arguing that if there is usury here, the judgment was excessive. And we agree with that. Basically what happened was the judgment was excessive by $2,904.84. And so just as a matter of law, you can calculate these out. And there is an appendix to the Court of Appeals brief by Colonial Pacific setting out an amortization schedule showing all this. And these figures are in our reply brief as well, showing what the correct judgment should be for the usury penalties. Now, so all this court has to do is really reform the judgment of the trial court since the matter of law is established that there was usury. The Colonial Pacific has alleged that there are two reasons why this cannot stand, the judgment. First of all, they claim that there was inadequate pleading in the trial court for a usury cause of action. Now, before trial, Mr. Kiner had pleadings saying that there was a violation of Article 5069. There were no special exceptions to that pleading, and during the trial, the court granted leave to file a trial amendment where it specified the violations of Article 5069 1.06 and asked for penalties under that provision. That trial amendment was objected to, but Colonial Pacific did not request a continuance or postponement because of that trial amendment, and the cases are clear that trial courts have wide discretion to allow trial amendments, and you have to show abuse of discretion to show that it's improper, and to preserve your error for a trial amendment that's improper, you have to show surprise and you have to ask for a continuance or a postponement. And there's a long list of cases on that point. And just as a matter of fact, they just did not ask for that postponement. So there was no abuse of discretion. That error was not even preserved. Second of all, they claimed that there was a time price differential involved, even though the jury found there wasn't. The requirements for a time price differential are real clear. And in fact, in one of the Rotello cases, Rotello versus International Harvester, is 624 Southwest 2nd, 249. I give you the site because there's another one that was prior to this that was a no writ case. This was NRE. In that case, it sets out the requirements, and one of those requirements is that the seller has to offer the two different prices, the cash price and the deferred price. Well, here, that didn't happen. Colonial Pacific never offered a cash price at all. Second of all, what they failed to do is that in Rotella it says that the cash price and the deferred price or the credit price have to be in the contract themselves. And this was not done at all either. All we had in there was the monthly payments. Also, you have to have the finance charge incorporated into the contract. And that wasn't done. So it failed on those three points to be a tie price differential. And the jury also already found that there was none involved here at all. Thirdly, what they attack is the recovery of attorney's fees under 5069. 5069-106 provides the recovery of attorney's fees when there's usurious interest charged or collected or contracted for. And the language of the statute says that you're entitled to attorney's fees to be fixed or set by the trial court. We put on testimony of attorney's fees in the trial court, and we submitted the judgment, and the trial court, fixed those attorney's fees in accordance with the evidence. So there was no issue submitted to the jury on attorney's fees under 5069. The only issue on attorney's fees was under the DTPA. But according to 106, the trial court can fix those fees himself, and that's exactly what he did, and there's sufficient evidence to support those findings in the testimony of Mr. Hall and another expert, Jim Pearson. Both of them testified to attorney's fees. So, in summary, the transaction was established to be a loan by looking at the intention of the parties. Therefore, as a matter of law, excessive interest was charged and contracted for, and the usury penalties can be applied, and there's no time price differential, and therefore we would ask this court to reform the judgment of the trial court and change the usury penalties to be what they should be, and otherwise affirm that judgment. Thank you.
Any questions? Thank you, Tim.
May I please record Mr. Temple Engel will present argument for the respondent.
May it please the court, I'm Temple Ingram. I'm the counsel for Colonial Leasing Company, DBA Colonial Pacific Leasing, in this case. I'll address the unconscionability question first and then the usury question. First of all, on the unconscionability question, the important facts here are that Mr. Kinard knew when he went to Florida that he was getting a sales pitch. He's not going down there just knowing that he wasn't dealing with some sharp operators. He knew at the time he was getting high-pressure sales.
Are you making an argument that there's no evidence to support the finding of unconscionability?
Yes, I will get to the question there. But I want you to understand also that we're not talking about somebody who goes down there and he gets hit hard.
Did I hear you agree it was a sale?
I'm sorry?
Did I hear you agree that
it
was
not,
a sale?
No, I have not agreed at this point that we have a sale between Colonial Pacific. What happened was, there's a distinction here between Colonial Pacific and Radiator Aid. In fact, Mr. Kinard said that he never talked to Colonial Pacific except in two instances before his attorney sent the DTPA letter. There was one time that he talked to Colonial Pacific. Colonial Pacific called and said, have you received the equipment and is it installed and working? Is it satisfactory? He said yes. As a result of that, the only evidence is that Colonial Pacific then paid Radiator Aid for this equipment. That Mr. Kinard had gone to Florida to see his counsel admit he viewed it. His counsel admit he selected the equipment. We never, that is Colonial Pacific, never saw it, never talked to him about it. The only other conversation, the only other communication with Mr. Kinard from Colonial Pacific was one more phone call where they asked, is it insured? That's the only communication with respect to this equipment prior to the DTPA letter some 3 years after the transaction. The testimony by Mr. Kinard is also that he wanted to pay cash. He wanted to pay Radiator Aid cash. His own counsel has said he was ready to do it. He's going to work through his own bank. But he was persuaded by Radiator Aid to enter into this contract. Again, Colonial Pacific paid $10,000 after Kinard said the equipment's fine. Colonial Pacific received, when you take the sales tax out, $9,353.41. Now, Mr. Kinard argues that there's evidence that shows Colonial Pacific greatly overcharged, and that resulted in a gross disparity between the value received and the consideration paid. First of all, Colonial would argue that there was no overcharge. Kinard paid less by contracting with Colonial Pacific than he would have paid otherwise. The cash price that he could purchase it for, he wasn't real happy about admitting it, but he said $10,000, and that's the only evidence on a cash price, was $10,000. Colonial Pacific paid $10,000 for this equipment. Then Kinard paid, even if you ignore the time value of money, he paid less than $10,000. If he had not entered into this contract, lease, financing arrangement, whatever you want to call it, if he had not entered into this contract, he would have bought the equipment and would have paid $10,000. As it was, he entered into the contract with Colonial Pacific and paid $9,350 or $9,600. So as far as there being any gross overcharge, what happened is Colonial Pacific paid $10,000, Kinard paid less than $10,000. Now, there's the other side of this, and that is they're arguing that there's a loan. Well, if there's a loan involved here, what did he get when you have, what do you get when you have a loan? You get the amount of the loan, the use of that. Well, if they're going to say there's a loan involved, obviously he got the loan of $10,000. He didn't get $2,000 worth of equipment. What did we, that is Colonial Pacific, give the man? $10,000, if there's a loan. Again, Kinder paid less than that $10,000. Now, assume, though, that there was a gross disparity. Assume that there was an overcharge. Did a gross disparity result? Because the statutory language requires that the unconscionable act, that is the gross overcharge, result in a gross disparity. You've got a but-for causation question here. That's in the statutory language, that's in the instruction which was given to the jury. But for, the statutory language is, the unconscionable action or course of action means an act or practice which to a person's detriment results in a gross disparity between the value received and the consideration paid. Well, even here today, first of all, there's a lot of talk about how much he agreed to pay. That's not the question. That was argued in the trial court. It was argued in the Court of Appeals. It's been argued again here. That's not the question. The question is, what did the man pay? He paid $9,000 and change. But what did Kinard testify? What's the only evidence on this question? He testified, and this is in the Statement of Facts at page 167, he testified he wanted to pay $10,000 cash. Radiator Aid persuaded him to enter into this contract with Colonial Pacific, and he ended up paying $9,350 after, plus the taxes. So he paid less by entering into this contract than he would have otherwise. But for the contract with Colonial Pacific, he would have paid $10,000. With the contract in this transaction, he paid less than $10,000. You have no but-for causation. It's not even a proximate cause question. It's a but-for causation, and there's no result. That's one of the statutory elements for unconscionability. In fact, in this transaction, Colonial Pacific's contract worked to Mr. Kinard's advantage. And it worked to his advantage in a number of ways. First of all, he paid less than he would have otherwise. Secondly, he came up with a solvent defendant after ignoring for 3 years the fact that this equipment was not what he wanted. Now, Mr. Kinard may argue, wait a minute, we don't know what this cash price was.
Let me ask you a question here.
Yes.
You're taking the position that because he paid, he was willing to pay Radiator $10,000, and he paid less to Colonial, that there can be no unconscionability. Is that what you're saying?
There is no unconscionable act by Colonial. There's no question. There's no question that Mr. Kinard was taken by Radiator.
All right. What do you do with, and I think it was Mr. Maxwell's argument, that the real issue is what it was worth to him as opposed to what he paid?
Well, I understand your question, but I don't think what I'm saying is that in terms of what happened here, what it was worth to him was $2,000 or nothing. I agree. The reason that Mr. Kinard agreed to purchase the equipment was he got a very hard sell from Radiator Aid. Basically, the complete theory, to a large degree in the trial court, was Radiator Aid was the agent, either authorized or apparent, for Colonial Pacific. I mean, that's, again, it's been argued here today that there was an agency relationship based on the fact that Mr. Kinard gave his check to Radiator Aid when he signed the documents. In fact, I don't question that the equipment was not worth the money that that Colonial Pacific paid to Radiator Aid. I don't question, for that matter, that it was not worth $9,353. But the point is that the injury to Mr. Kinard resulted not from this contract. What did Colonial Pacific do here? First of all, there weren't a lot of conversations and communications with Radiator Aid. In fact, the only testimony was that there was one telephone call from Radiator Aid at which certain credit information which Radiator Aid had gotten from Mr. Kinard was given to Colonial Pacific. Colonial Pacific then did a credit check, got a credit report from the credit bureau, and then based on that went ahead and tentatively approved the submission of the contract documents, prepared the contract documents, and sent them to Florida.
Isn't the evidence undisputed that Colonial Pacific actually got title to this equipment? I mean, it went through from Radiator to Colonial to Mr. Kinard?
That's correct. That is the evidence, yes. There's no question.
If it were a pure financing, where they were just loaning money and took this money and got these payments in return, they'd be in a much stronger position.
Yes, they would. But what I'm saying is they had no connection with the transaction other than
with
simply
the representation.
That's right. The representation.
But then even conceding that is staying out of the inextricably intertwinability of the case. You owned it and sold it for an amount that the jury found was grossly excessive, and they found all the elements of the unconscionability. And you've got to attack that finding somehow.
That's correct, Your Honor, but what I am saying here is that we did not overcharge for the equipment. What I'm saying is there is no but-for causation here, assuming that there was an overcharge, assuming that you take the $10,000, the $9,300, and the $2,000. You still have to show that if we had not done what we did, and the only thing we did was enter into this contract. That's the only thing we did. If we had not entered into this contract, Mr. Kinard himself, if that contract had not been there, he would have paid cash, and he would have paid $10,000. Now, again, he may argue, well, we don't know what this cash price was. Maybe it was $10,000. Maybe it was not $10,000. Maybe it was more, maybe it was less. If it was more, the cash price was more, then he was damaged, even his damages, his loss as a result of what Radiator Aid did is even lower. If it's less, then we don't know what the disparity is. If it's less, maybe he could have gotten a cash price for $2,000. Then we've got no disparity at all. Kinard had the burden of proving all of the elements of his cause of action, including the element that this unconscionable action or course of action, this lease that we, or this contract that we entered into, the transaction, the sale that we entered into, resulted in the gross disparity between the value received and the consideration paid. And that's the point. It did not result. There is no but-for causation here. If Mr. Kinard had not testified at trial that he wanted to pay cash, he could pay cash, but they talked him into it, then I wouldn't be here arguing this, obviously. Then I would not, then he would have not provided me with that question of but-for causation. But he did. He said that. So given what he said, where there is no evidence of this but-for causation, again, the question may come up, well, the contract entered into the decision. Well, the contract did not. There was no evidence presented at all that this contract, Colonial Pacific's contract, entered into Kinard's decision to obtain, to purchase, to buy, whatever, this equipment. It just was not part of his decision. So the Court of Appeals did not err in reversing the trial court and rendering judgment for Colonial Pacific on this unconscionability claim because he presented no evidence on this causation question. Now, if the court desires, I will address the questions of agency and inextricable intertwining. As far as inextricable intertwining, I would simply point out to the court that that term never appeared anywhere in this case until Mr. Kinard's appellee's brief in the Court of Appeals. In this case, as far as inextricable intertwining is concerned, is more like the Guetta case last summer, where this court said there were no pleadings and no findings on inextricable intertwining. Now, Mr. Kinard's arguments as to usury are very interesting, but I don't really think they're all that relevant, because he simply has not brought any error up to this court for review. Mr. Kinard's points of error in the Court of Appeals were identical to his points of error in this court. The point of error one says the Court of Appeals erred in reversing the trial court and rendering judgment for Colonial Pacific on the basis of the provision of Texas Revised Civil Statute 5069-6.01 because the statute does not apply to the contract. We agree, we've never said the statute did apply to the contract. It applies to consumer transactions. This was not a consumer transaction. There is nothing in that point of error that says anything about the evidence, that says anything about the elements of usury, nothing. The only other usury point of error is point of error 14. Which said that there was error because Colonial Pacific, on the basis, again, of 5069-6.01F, which is basically a venue statute, I believe, Colonial Pacific presented no point of error on this point in the Court of Appeals, and Colonial Pacific has not challenged the right of Kinard to bring a usury action in the state of Texas. Again, that's true. We never did, but we don't have. That's not what the Court of Appeals decided. Now, they've read this statement that the contract which Colonial Pacific furnished did not violate any of the laws of this state. That's also, and then there's a citation 5069-6.01F. That's not the Court of Appeals ruling. That's a simple parenthetical statement made during the distinction of the Knight case. The ruling, the decision, was from page 674 of the Court of Appeals decision. Points of error 11, 13, and 15 are sustained. And that's addressing issue 14. Point of error 15 was a clear, no evidence point. There may be some, this may not be the best opinion that's ever been written by a Court of Appeals, but it was clear that my point of error, number 15, was a no evidence point. And if you did, if opposing counsel did not understand what the Court of Appeals said in its decision, opposing counsel certainly could have determined from reading point of error 14 that I wasn't talking about. I mean, he knew. His own point of error said that I wasn't talking about a venue statute. The question of the evidence was also, the point of error brought forth in this court was the same as in the Court of Appeals. It's very interesting when you start looking at the briefs, there's no one addresses the evidence, but no one for Mr. Kiner addresses the evidence until at least the reply brief, if not in the motion for rehearing. At that point, we start to see something about the evidence. Again, this court cannot rule as it did in Poole versus Ford Motor Company that the complained error is readily apparent from the argument brief because it wasn't. There's no statement, no reference at all. So if the Court of Appeals did it in finding that there was no evidence to support a usury judgment, that error has not been preserved. Now let's go to the question of, okay, that being so, what are we looking at? Well, I don't really want to just jump right into it because there's reasons why points of error are supposed to be brought forward. But what are we looking at here then? The Court of Appeals never addressed the question of whether there was a time-price differential involved. Time-price differentials under the usury statute under Article 5069, Article 1, or Title 1.
Back up. On preservation of error in respect to usury, what is your contention in this regard again?
The only points of error that he has brought forward are points of error saying that the Court of Appeals, in ruling, made its decision based on 5069-6.01F. His points of error 1 and 14 both cite only to 5069-6.01F. The first one, point of error 1, states that statute does not apply to the decision was wrong because that statute does not apply to the contract between Colonial Pacific and Kinard, which is a contract concerning business or commercial use. Rather, section 5069-1.01 to 1.06 are the applicable statutes. That is his point of error. His point of error 14 is that the decision is wrong because denying Kinard recovery for usury on the basis of no violation of 5069.01 because Colonial Pacific has presented no point of error on this point. This is what I'm reading to you right now is what he said on the motion for rehearing in the Court of Appeals. And two, Colonial Pacific has not challenged the right of Kiner to bring a usury action in the state of Texas. Those are his two points of error, period. There's nothing in either one of those that talks about the evidence. There's nothing in the argument under those points that talks about the evidence. The reason for the requirement of points of error is simply so the court below can correct its own errors. And the court below had no opportunity because no proper point of error and no argument was presented to it on this particular question. Now as to, again, the inextricable intertwining question, again I would say that the Home Savings versus Guetta case is dispositive. There were no pleadings and there were no findings. There's also the fact that they say there's no relevancy to the fact in this case. Let me back up to the usury question now. If this court were to send this question back to the Court of Appeals on usury, the Court of Appeals has not ruled on the question, the properly preserved, on whether there was a time-price differential, whether there was any evidence to support the finding of no time-price differential, and whether the evidence was proper. What we're talking about here is a time-price differential in any transaction under Section 1. We're not talking about a consumer transaction where there are certain reporting requirements. When you're talking about a transaction under Section 1 with a time price differential, if it is a time price differential, it does not fall within the provisions of Article 1 of the usury statute, the usury statute itself, as opposed to the Consumer Credit Code. All of the requirements under the Consumer Credit Code for certain things to be set out in the document are in Sections 2 on. There's not a single reporting or documentary requirement in the first section. So the fact that we didn't have the cash price, and the fact that we didn't have the finance charge, all of those things are simply not applicable. Those are requirements for which he could get his own independent recovery if those were required under the statute. That's what Article 8 provides. Assuming you've got proper interest and everything else, you can still get a penalty under Article 8, under 5069-8. Up to $4,000 for simple failure to put in the APR. If that's not in there, you get, I believe it's double the amount of the interest, but I'd have to check the statute to make sure. Up to $4,000. When we look at the pleadings in the trial court, it's clear that that's what his claim was initially. He claimed $4,000, the pretrial pleading. He did refer to 5069, but he said the Consumer Credit Code. Well, the only Consumer Credit Code there is Section 2 on. The usury statute in the first part of 5069 is not the Consumer Credit Code. And that's clear because it says, I believe it says usury on the first part, and I know it says consumer transactions or consumer credit for 2 through 8 and on past there. So we're talking about two different things as far as notice. We were told in pretrial that we're talking consumer credit, 5069 consumer credit. You couldn't have anything, the only way you could have been more specific would be say 5069-2.01 et sec. It's the same thing. So that's, as far as notice on that question, that's where that comes from as far as the requirements of including the APR, the original, the cash price, and therefore, since it was not in there, it can't be a time price differential. It's not required under the usury statute, only under the Consumer Credit Code. Under the circumstances, again, Your Honors, since the question of usury was not properly preserved, I would argue that the Court of Appeals decision on the usury, reversing and rendering the judgment for Colonial Pacific on usury, should be affirmed by this court.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel.
Your Honors, I think Mr. Kinard would be very interested, and he should have come today to find out how it was that not only did Colonial not do anything to him unconscionably, but they actually saved him money in this transaction. I think it would come as a great surprise to a man who thought he was purchasing a product that was going to advance his business and get him into a new productive enterprise, got something that's worth $2,000 and obligated himself to pay $16,000 to be told that he was spared the indignity of paying $10,000 cash so he could obligate himself to pay $16,000.
Let me ask a question, and I'm going to go first, and you answer it slowly.
Okay.
On the one hand, your position is that Colonial Leasing purchased this equipment, was the owner of it, and sold it to Mr. to your client.
That's correct.
And to a gross disparity in the sale price as opposed to the value, which entitles you to DTPA recovery. Then on the other hand, your position seems to be that there was that $16,000 was usurious interest, that it was really a $10,000 transaction for which interest was charged in excess of the amounts allowed under law, and that it was a loan transaction.
Well,
and I'm I, I, I'm just a little curious. It seems to be the first half of the case we seem to be talking about a sale, and then we seem to be talking about a loan.
Well, that's because when I call them strange creatures, I wasn't kidding. It is these two transactions coexist in the same document. The
you don't person, think we have to, or that in fairness we should choose?
We're not called upon to choose. The transactions, if you will, is a neutral term, coexist in the same document. It is both a sale to the consumer, and there is a loan traction a loan transaction going on. He is being extended credit. He is being allowed to pay out a $10,000 purchase price over a longer term, 60 months in this
would
case.
Would Colonial have accepted $10,000?
Pardon me?
Would Colonial have accepted $10,000?
Colonial put on no evidence as to what it would have accepted.
Under the document, could he prepay and avoid some of the interest payments?
No. There's no availability of prepayment. He was obligated to pay the lease payment until the lease was over with. And indeed, I was about to say the only reason he was spared paying the rest of this money that counsel said he gratuitously spared me from having to pay, or Mr. Kinder from having to pay, is because he was unsuccessful in his counterclaim. They accelerated the soft recovery of the balance.
Under the acceleration, when they accelerated, they did not charge for unaccrued interest?
They did. As a matter of fact, it was not urged.
You say that?
It was not urged by the trial court. It was not urged at the trial court level, but when I read this record, it was clear to me that not only was there a contracting for usurious interest, and this court's well aware that the charge received or contracted for, that there was a charge of usurious interest at the time of the acceleration, there was a charge of usurious interest at the time that counterclaim was filed, that there was no credit given for unearned interest, that all monies in the future were claimed due. It would be just like a note at a bank where you're supposed to pay out over the future, and you default, and they accelerate it, but they accelerate your future interest payments until you pay interest that you have not even got the benefit of time for, and that's what happened in this case. So in my judgment, really, if we want to really reform this judgment, it ought to be three times, because there were three separate acts of charging and contracting for in this case. And
you don't have any cases, sorry.
I do not, Your Honor, but the statute imposes the penalties on each separate act and uses the disjunctive or in between them. But anyway, that's what happened in this case. On the issue of the point of error, lawyers can always hope that they would draft their points of error better than they end up drafting them, but surely under this court's ruling as to what brings forth an error, surely a point of error that says that Article 5069, 1.01 to 1.06 are the applicable statutes and complains of a judgment based on those statutes being taken away from him amply brings forth the error of Article 1 not being complied with and followed by the Court of Appeals in this case. Admittedly, the point of error goes on to talk about 6.01. I would have done so too, since that's what the court rests its hat on. Is 6.01 not being applicable because of the contract not being entered into in Texas. So it seems to me the error is amply before the court. Home Savings versus Guerra. Your Honors, in that case, it was a home sales transaction, a home solicitation transaction case. The DTPA was not pled. The financer here was an assignee of the contract. There was no finding of any conduct on behalf of Home Savings. No special issues submitted. In this case, there was pleadings, was special issues submitted, was a finding of inconstability, was a finding of producing cause, and nothing counsel has said detracts from the evidence and the record in this case. Nothing further, Your Honors.
Any questions? That concludes the business of the court for this day. And Marshall.